You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. Today's mystery is, what finally brought the ABA and NBA together? Hey, this is Jason, and this is part four, the final part of my conversation with Rainus Lattice of the Handle Podcast, talking about the off-court battles between the ABA and the NBA. In this episode, we are going to talk about George McGinnis going to the NBA, David Thompson signing with the ABA, and how the battles between the ABA and NBA ended. We previously discussed how the ABA formed in part one, talked about Spencer Haywood's landmark legal case, bringing underclassmen into the pros in part two. And in part three, we talked a lot about the bidding wars between the two leagues in the early 1970s. So if you haven't listened to those episodes, I recommend you go back first to those before you listen to this one. Today, we are brought to you by the Fast Break Breakfast Podcast. Fast Break Breakfast is a podcast for serious NBA fans that is incredibly not serious. Check out what happens when you get two musicians and a comic who are overeducated, underemployed, but share an obsession about the NBA, 90s movies, and conspiracy theories. So make sure you subscribe to Fast Break Breakfast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcast, or check it out at The Step Back. We are joined in progress with Rainus discussing 1974 and the beginning of the end for the ABA. So the 1974 draft, for Consensus All-Americans, the NBA gets Bill Walton, Jamal Wilkes, and Campy Russell. The ABA, Marvin Barnes, who's number two in the NBA draft, who would have gone to Philadelphia. Bobby Jones, number five, would have gone to Houston. Billy Knight and Len Elmore. Other notable players for the NBA, John Drew, Scott Wedman, Chuck Robinson, Phil Smith, Tom Burleson. And for the ABA, Maurice Lucas. So, interestingly enough, I mean, you... that's actually fairly close. The NBA had more bulk of very good players, but the top level players, I mean, Walton and Barnes were both disappointing in different ways. I mean, Walton obviously had more team success and, you know, led Portland to a championship and all of that. But, you know, Bobby Jones and, you know, Billy Knight, the secondary players, and Maurice Lucas, you know, the ABA probably did a little bit better in total talent there at the top level, even if the NBA's depth was stronger.
And in a way, Philly might have dodged the bullet there, because when you think of the 77 team that went to the finals, everybody always mentions the lack of cohesiveness on the court and the fact that there were too many egos involved. And it's remarkable to think of a team that would also have Marvin Barnes on the roster, besides, of course, Julius, who was a class person, but besides George McGinnis and then Steve Mix and all the other colorful personalities on that team.
Yeah, that would have been something for sure. June of 74, this isn't really related to the ABA, but I thought it was interesting. The NBA votes to award an expansion franchise to Toronto for the 76 season. They actually awarded to the city, not to an ownership group, which is the first time, probably only time ever. But then later would change their mind in January of 75 and vote not to. Probably couldn't find an ownership group, or thought that the logistics of having a team in Toronto at that point weren't good. But I did find that kind of fascinating. Had you heard that before?
No, first time I've heard it. And yeah, that I think the detail about it being awarded to a city, it's even more fascinating than the fact that Toronto and Canada could have had a franchise for basically 40 years now.
Yeah. In August of 74, Utah signed Moses Malone out of high school. He would become the first player to be signed out of high school. In October of 74, Wilt Chamberlain leaves the Cues after a season there as coach. In December of 74, the Spirits of St. Louis, who had just started operation after coming from the Carolina Cougars, they suspended Joe Caldwell. Talked about it in a previous show with the Rich, but the justification for that was that he had led Marvin Barnes astray, which is always a always an amusing idea. But Caldwell would basically be blackballed from the NBA and ABA for the rest of his career, and there would be many lawsuits regarding that after the ABA was done over with mostly with Ted Munchak, who had been the Cougars owner, over monies that he felt he hadn't been paid or issues that he had dealt with there. But that was the end of his indefinite suspension that ended his career. In January of 75, the ABA announced that a Cincinnati Cougars franchise would replace one of the current teams in the next season. That did not come to pass, but interesting that they had plans to do that. There had been talk about moving Louisville to Cincinnati at one point, but John Y. Brown had stepped in and had kept the Colonels in Louisville. And Cincinnati, of course, the Royals had recently left Cincinnati and moved to Kansas City and become the Kings. So that was had an NBA history. January of 75, also, Golden State accused the Lakers of tampering when they had signed Cassie Russell essentially as a free agent. Now, this was before official free agency, but there was the sort of a loophole in which the Lakers had been able to sign Cassie Russell. However, the Warriors ended up getting a pick out of the they were awarded a pick that which became Robert Parrish of all things. So they ended up doing pretty well with that. In February of 75, a district court ruled against an NBA ABA player to a joint NBA and ABA effort to end a lawsuit by the players, and a federal judge upheld their right to pursue a class action lawsuit, continuing that for another year. Then in May of 1975, Dave DeBuscher is named the ABA commissioner, and also that month, the George McGinnis ends up suing the NBA and challenging the legality of the NBA draft so that he can negotiate with the Knicks as a free agent. Now, this is an interesting, very complicated situation. McGinnis had, of course, gone to the ABA with the Pacers. It led them to two championships, and then another. They were just coming off of a finals appearance in 75. They were sort of an underdog team that he led them to the finals, was co-MVP of the league, so about as big of a star as it got. But a year previously, the Knicks had and the 76ers had agreed on a deal which would have sent the rights to McGinnis to the Knicks, provided that the Knicks could sign him, I think it was within 90 days. And the deal apparently would have involved sending Earl Monroe a pick in cash to the Sixers. And then after negotiations ended up falling through, and McGinnis signed a long-term contract with the Pacers, but it included an opt-out clause after 1 year. So this was after this 1 year, and he was back at the table. Interestingly enough, McGinnis said at the time in 74 that he wasn't ready to make the move to New York, and Walt Frazier, who had taken him out in the town, agreed, saying that I think George got scared by all the tall buildings.
Yeah, and what I love the most about all of this is a nugget that can be found in an article at rememberTheABA.com, which was written at the time by Dan Patterson. And Dan mentioned that the Pacers went as far as going to court in an effort to prevent McGinnis from negotiating with the Knicks, and he succeeded and obtained temporary restraining orders against McGinnis, the Knicks, and the 76ers. So, yeah, a classic NBA versus the ABA clash.
Yeah, and then in 75, it's interesting because when his agents went to the Knicks and wanted to negotiate again, the Knicks apparently said no, but then the attorneys for McGinnis insisted that if the Knicks now refused to deal with him, having shown such interest before, they'll be violating the antitrust clause by agreeing with Philadelphia and the rest of the NBA to boycott him, which that one just kind of the logic there is really interesting.
Yeah, it's really.
And then eventually McGinnis signed a 6-year, $3.1 million deal with the Knicks, despite the Sixers holding his rights. The Knicks owners called the Sixers, asked what they wanted for McGinnis, and then Irv Kozloff, the Sixers owner, responded for the NBA to take your expletive deleted franchise away. And then later his quote would be, "The act of the New York Knickerbockers in signing George McGinnis to a contract was an open violation of the draft, which they have participated in and benefited from. My initial reaction when I learned of this outrageous deed was to call it an act of piracy. Having reflected upon it, I now see it more as treason. No amount of time that passed or that may pass can quiet the rage within me and the entire organization. So, eventually, June of 75, Larry O'Brien has just taken office. He disallows McGinnis's deal with the Knicks, takes away their 1976 first-round pick, and then McGinnis signed a six-year, $3.2 million deal with Philly, who actually were now a much better team than they had been in 74. So it actually, you know, in 74, he hadn't been interested in there. Philly was just a year or so away from that nine-win team that was terrible. Now they'd gotten Doug Collins and some other pretty good talent. So they, you know, were in much better position than they had been just the year previous.
Yeah, and meanwhile, the Knicks are probably on the downfall as their veterans from those championship teams are aged. The Bushers already the commissioner of the ABA, so it's a situation where Philly is definitely going well the opposite side. So you can see how McGinnis would change his mind over that period of time.
So in May of 1975, Walter Kennedy turned down an offer for a best of five Colonels Warriors series, which I think was the only official where one of the leagues asked the other league. I know there were some informal ones like the Oakland Oaks challenged the Celtics, Alex Hannum in 69, and there were a couple other ones where they definitely talked about it. But I think that was maybe the only official one where there was an invitation to do it, and of course it didn't happen. But as we talked about in some of the in our On the Court episode where we talked about some of our mythical finals matchups, that would have been a fun one to see.
Yeah, and I think this is the one where we had the Colonels as the favorites, though we weren't sure about their playoff success, as they did have some bad years in regards to fulfilling the high promise they had. But I do remember that the ABA had the Nets offering something similar to the Boston Celtics in 1976.
Okay.
So
yes,
those might have been the 75 champions. Yeah, but that might have been a single game, not a series. This is likely the only time where there was a best of five proposal on the table.
In the 75 draft, the consensus All-Americans, NBA got Dave Myers, Gus Williams, and Kevin Grevey. ABA got David Thompson, who was number one in the NBA draft, and Tiki Burton. Other notables, non-All-Americans, NBA got Daryl Dawkins straight out of high school, Alvin Adams, Lionel Hollins, World Be Free, and the ABA got Marvin Webster and Dan Rounfield. So, and Marvin Webster was the number three pick in the draft. So this was really, Marvin Barnes the year before, and then this year there are some really high NBA draft choices who are going to the ABA. And we'll get to more of that in just a moment, but June of 75, the ABA adopted a 24-second clock. We had previously had a 30-second clock for its history. One thought is that they wanted to make themselves more like the NBA as part of their appeal to hopefully merge together, which I think everyone in the ABA at this point is seeing the writing on the wall and realizing that league does not probably have much more of a future, and I don't know if adopting the 24-second clock made that easier in any way, but I guess it couldn't hurt. July of 1975, the Nuggets officially signed David Thompson and Marvin Webster. Now, the Atlanta Hawks had drafted them number one and number three in the NBA draft, so the Hawks lost out on both players, amazingly. The Hawks... the Nuggets, their appeal to David Thompson was that Larry Brown and Doug Moe, Larry Brown had been had gone to North Carolina, and Thompson had been in NC State, so they had a relationship together, both part of the North Carolina family, even though they had gone to the rival schools. And they'd also signed David Thompson's friend Monty Toe, who was his college teammate, so that was another appeal. The Hawks... supposedly it offered him more real money sooner, but the Nuggets had the deferred payments and ultimately a larger amount in total. Now, there's a story about the Hawks taking Thompson to McDonald's as whether, you know, perhaps that was the Hawks being arrogant or ignorant or what have you. Now, whether that actually happened or not is speculation. I couldn't find anything concrete on that, but that's if that is actually what they did, that whether or not it actually mattered in the end, when the optics did not look good. And of course, this was a huge loss for the Hawks, because the merger would happen in the next year, and then they would not have they would not get Thompson and Webster. After that, they would stay with the, well, Webster would be a free agent and would go to the Sonics and then the Knicks. David Thompson would of course stay with the Nuggets. So the Hawks lost out on two building blocks, which they were had emerging from a rebuilding situation after they had lost Pete Maravich. And after the previous attempts to sign Julius Erving didn't work out for them. So the Hawks definitely had a lot of poor luck when it came to the ABA.
Yeah, and it's hard for me to tell how high does our audience value David Thompson, but it really should be on the level of Dr. J. His NC State team went 30-1 when he was a sophomore. Center Tom Burleson was a noteworthy player, but other than that, they had the 5'7 Monty Tau, who you mentioned, and he might have been their third best option. And they defeated Marvin Barnes's Providence team, Bill Walton's and UCLA team, and on the way to their to the title. And Thompson averaged 26-6-4 his first year in the ABA. So David Thompson was the real deal, and a shooting guard who more so resembles perhaps today's guards. And getting him what might have been just as big as getting Dr. J, but obviously the merger would come in a year, and his career and the way that turned out is a completely another story. Yeah, David Thompson was really good.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, he was, he was in a prototype of Michael Jordan. Not that good, but because obviously no one's that good, but he was very much the same type of player, and a player that Jordan, fashioned his game after, and very much had, similar skills and similar, was exciting in a similar way. In September of 75, the Nuggets and the Nets applied for NBA membership. This very much upset, of course, the rest of the ABA teams who were, at that point, the Nuggets and the Nets were the two strongest teams, at least in terms of talent. The remaining teams actually applied in October for the 77 season, but the NBA declined to take any action on the applications because of the Oscar Robertson suit. In November of 75, the ABA Players Union gets involved in suing to block the merger, claiming that the Nets, the Nuggets, and the Colonels, who were sort of affiliated with this applying for NBA membership stuff, I don't know if they ever, well, I guess they officially did when the other teams did, but they were sort of on the, John LeBron may have sort of been playing both sides of this, and it claimed that the, those three teams were conspiring to put the ABA out of business.
So some of the teams, meanwhile, are basically going out of business, as I'm sure you will allude in just a few seconds.
Yeah, exactly. We're in October, November, and December. Baltimore Claws fold. The San Diego, who changed the name to the Sales, had folded. Utah folded. Virginia was very, very near folding, although they would manage to survive the season. So yeah, the league goes down from. It goes down to just seven teams for the full season. So the league is showing the signs of falling apart. And in that vein, in December of 75, the NBA actually has a draft of ABA undergraduates. There's lawsuits over this. The ABA sues to considers it a unlawful conspiracy and a violation of the Sherman Act. Eventually and kind of connects it to Denver and the Nets applying for the NBA. Eventually they delay it, but they do hold the draft on December 30th, 1975. The Jazz draft Moses Malone, who had been with the had been with Utah and then went to St. Louis. The Lakers draft Mark Olberding of the Spurs. The Jazz and the Lakers would later forfeit those picks under the merger agreement, but then they gained draft picks in the 77 draft that they had previously forfeited when they made these expansion or whatever you would call it, whatever kind of draft you would call this. The 76ers drafted Mel Bennett, and Bennett would actually join the team later as a free agent after the merger, although he'd be traded to Indiana before the 77 season for a first-round pick that would later become Andrew Toney. So a good deal for the 76ers there. And the Warriors drafted Skip Wise, and the Buffalo Braves drafted Charles Jordan, neither of whom played in the ABA. So very much a footnote, but and didn't really lead to much, but interesting nonetheless.
And I believe Skip Wise is the phenom out of Baltimore. I don't remember which college he played for, but he was, it could have been Clemson. He was pretty much on drugs at that time. So his career ended up, his career basically ended before it really started. He was in a couple of practices for the Baltimore Hustlers, I believe.
That's right. Yes. And yeah, he'd played at Dunbar High School, and you're right, he did play for Clemson. He was the first freshman to be all ACC. So was certainly a that's right. He was the one in Loose Balls that was mentioned that the coach found him shivering in the locker room. There was knowledge that drugs were going on, but probably heroin was outside of the purview of most of the NBA, ABA players during this time. I mean, cocaine was obviously had become a major thing, in marijuana, of course, but I think heroin was outside the bounds of most of the experience of the players and the coaches during that point.
Yeah, you certainly didn't expect your 20-year-old rookie shivering in the locker room,
right? Exactly,
for that matter.
Yes, yes. So, January of 76, the district court, a U.S. district court, rules that the college draft and the reserve clause violate the Antitrust Act and that the merger would be anti-competitive. Then in February 76, the Oscar Robertson suit is finally settled by the players' union and the NBA, giving players limited free agency and ending the option clause. And then in March 76, a court documents reveal that the NBA has actually been helping pay the salaries of some of its top players, as opposed to the teams having, which is interesting because that, given the reputation of the ABA and the NBA, that's more of something that the ABA would have been more likely to do than the reputation of what the NBA was doing. But apparently they were, of course, given the way that the salaries had risen so much, there was some that was sort of understandable that the league would have kind of been at that point.
Yeah, that's a bit surprising to learn. Yeah, because the ABA at that point, I believe, was helping Denver with David Thompson. Mike Storin was, I think, helping one of the teams which was pretty much weeks from bankrupt. But as this reveals, the NBA was doing just as bad, and probably both of the leagues were. In that part of the Cold War where they're just longing for the merger, so all of this could end because nobody would have been a winner if this went on for another season.
Absolutely. So April 76, a federal judge orders the NBA and the ABA to appear for a settlement of the antitrust suit, or the trial could begin in July. So the union lawsuit is settled, but there's still the ABA's antitrust suit against the NBA to be dealt with. May of 1976, CBS actually offered a $5 million incentive for the leagues to merge, which I hadn't heard of as well, but they obviously believed in the financial appeal, I think mostly of Julius Erving being part of the league and the television ratings that could bring. And then June of 76, we finally have a merger. We'll have an episode coming up with Adam Cribley to discuss the details of the actual merger itself, but we're finally here. The battle is over. We have peace in our time, I guess.
Yeah, and as this episode revealed, it took quite some time. It was a bit towards the beginning of the conversation when you talked about the agreement that was reached in I believe 1970, and then that in 3 years the leagues would merge. But it took quite the legal battles and many years to come for the leagues actually to merge and to set off a new time in pro basketball in the United States.
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's anything overall that lessons that we take from just the way the battle went back and forth, or anything that, you know, just kind of looking at it, you know, sort of as a whole, looking at it as a timeline, if there's anything that stands out to you as far as, you know, something that, you know, a lesson or something that sort of comes together from you that you sort of realize once you kind of look at it from this approach.
The overall arc I see is that the business was just so cutthroat that so many of the players involved became casualties, and I guess that's the sad part when you think about the careers of guys like Jim McDaniels, who never achieved the things he could have, but was a chess piece in all of this. So I guess the lesson here is that nobody. Or at least the majority don't survive a war, and it's a good that it's eventually ended with the merger.
There were so many obstacles to getting the merger done that the fact that it actually finally happened, rather than the ABA going out of business, is kind of remarkable. I mean, there were so many things that were against it, and there was so much ill will that was engendered, you know, over the years. And, you know, from the ABA's perspective, you know, it's like this NBA is like this behemoth that, you know, treats us like we're, you know, this, like they were these ragtags and doesn't give us respect, and, you know, so on and so forth, and, you know, isn't really well run. You know, we're a much better run league than they are. We understand the pulse of the fans. And with the NBA side is, you know, these upstart, you know, guys, like, you know, they're taking advantage of all these kids, and they're, you know, these having all these unethical business practices and so forth. And I think there's kind of truth on both sides, but the fact that, you know, they finally, you know, I guess money solves a lot of problems, because, you know, that was sort of the, you know, what was thought to be the, you know, that they thought that, okay, bringing it all together will make a lot of money. And, you know, it did in the long term, although the short term, there was a lot of costs that went on. Although I guess it was costing both sides money and legal fees so much to, you know, continue on with the lawsuits, that just ending that aspect of it certainly was better for the bottom line of both leagues.
Yeah, a much better point than my rambling. And to your point, when you look at the supposedly stable teams of the ABA, the Indiana Pacers and the Kentucky Colonels, who certainly dominated the early 70s, they were pretty much close to bankrupt. There recently was that 30 for 30 short on the telephone. The Indiana Pacers had to run in the late 70s because of the money problems they had. And when you look at the they made, I believe this is the summer of 1975, Kentucky sold Dan Issel. Indiana gave away its players with huge legacies, who, despite being veterans at that point, it was, I'm sure it was hard to see them go. So if it would have been another season, the ABA really might have not had a chance. I don't know what happens if they fall mid through the year. Maybe some of the owners find a way to get a place in the NBA, but it seems like the ABA could have had gone another year, and then basketball history would have been changed.
Absolutely. Well, Reynis, is there anything you'd like to let listeners know about before we finish up?
I guess since we were talking about the ABA in the 70s, and any listeners who are interested in this can check out the Handle podcast, whether you can find it on my Twitter page at Lamarmatic or on lamarmatic.com. And the recent episode I had with Daryl Carrier, who was one of the pioneers of the three-point shot, him and Louis Dampier made it really popular. One of the seasons they even outshot the Indiana Pacers, who were second in threes made. So I had a great time talking about him and picking his brain about basketball in the late 60s and the early 70s. So yeah, that's something that listeners might be interested in.
Thanks again to Reynis for being on the show and having such an in-depth conversation with me about the ABA-NBA off-court battles. You can check out his work at lamarmatic.com. Highly recommend it. You can find us at The Step Back at fansided.com, and also on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are played. Just search for Over and Back or The Step Back. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. Hopefully you've been enjoying our Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s series, in particular our little mini-series here on the ABA-NBA off-court battles. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.